Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. James Dowd, and we're going to talk about his book, The Vitamin D Cure. I've had him on before, but I've had so many people asking for him to come back that we've got him for a second time. Thank you, Dr. Dowd, for taking the time to come on my show tonight.
Oh, thanks for the ask.
So before we get started, why don't you tell people a little bit about you and where they can find you and where they can buy your book, The Vitamin D Cure?
I'm an adult and pediatric rheumatologist, and I practice in Michigan, just north of Ann Arbor, in a town called Brighton. I was trained at the University of Texas in Dallas for my rheumatology, both in pediatric and adult rheumatology. In 2010, I became board certified in integrative holistic medicine. That followed the writing of the book, The Vitamin D Cure, which came out in January of 2008, and really marked that time and the couple of years prior to that sort of marked a transformation in how I practice medicine and how I saw the practice of medicine. And it sort of reinvigorated my career, and I really enjoy coming to work every day and seeing patients and really thinking differently about their problems than probably most of their doctors have been, and including the doctors who referred the patients to me. So that's sort of my story. The book is available at all the major book outlets online and in this real world, if you will, the tangible world, so you can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it on Amazon. There are e-books available, so you can get it pretty much anywhere.
And where can people find you on the Internet?
My website is drjamesdowd.com, and we just refurbished the website about a month ago. We're still working out some glitches and probably polishing it up a little bit and hopefully make more information accessible. So the book, my practice, and everything sort of about me or connected to me is on that one website.
And it's jamesdowd.com, or is it Dr. James?
Dr. Jamesdowd.com.
Okay, just wanted to make sure everybody knew how to spell your last name. Okay, mm-hmm. Since I've had you on before, I'm just going to kind of get to the meat and potatoes because that interview is still on my archive that people listen to. So,
okay.
One thing I want to ask you is, inevitably, when I tell people why they might need vitamin D, they say, I'm out in the sun all day. There's no way that I can need it. Or they will say, well, I already take vitamin D. I take 1,000 units a week. Talk to me about that. Does that question make sense to you? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I guess let me tell you a story first. After I interviewed you, I went and had my vitamin D levels checked, and it was like off the chart low. So I started supplementing with vitamin D, and I weighed about 155 or 60 pounds. I'm 5'6" or 7" tall. And I took 50,000 units a week for a year and went back and had my vitamin D levels tested again, and they had barely moved. So it taught me something about bioavailability of different kinds of supplements. So that's kind of why I want you. And I'm out in the sun all the time. I live in the country. I have a garden. So just kind of wanted you to talk about those things for a moment, if you would.
Okay. So we... Evolution, our time on this planet as we've sort of evolved, has evolved a mechanism of producing vitamin D from sun exposure. And this is, there are differences between other primates and us in that other primates are covered with fur, and they live in trees in dense forest, and so they don't actually get as much vitamin D exposure, but they may absorb it differently, and their production mechanisms are slightly different than the upright walking hominids who left the forest, that is us, who don't have this fur covering us. And we rely heavily, the Homo sapiens rely heavily on sun exposure to produce adequate amounts of vitamin D. So sunlight vitamin D starts out as cholesterol from your liver, is converted to 7-dehydrocholesterol, is transported in fat molecules to the skin, where it sits in the subcutaneous fat. The warmth of the sun and ultraviolet B radiation, that's B as in boy, radiation, causes a stereochemical twist in 7-dehydrocholesterol. It returns to the liver where it's hydroxylated and becomes 25-hydroxy vitamin D, which is the level we measure in the blood that gives us an idea of what our capacity for vitamin D production, the actual hormone, is. if we don't get enough, so that's the rate-limiting step. If we don't get enough ultraviolet B radiation, we can't twist that molecule and ready it for conversion to 25-hydroxy D.
Okay, I think we're having a technical difficulty, and my producer is going to pull you off and put you on a different line. So I don't know that they can hear you, so I'm going to talk just for a minute. And for my listeners, if you can't hear Dr. Dowd, just give us a minute. We're having a technical difficulty, but we're going to fix it. So now that listening what you've just said, it brings up a question to mind that when my producer comes back on and tells us that they can hear you again. If with all the medications that people are taking for the alleged hypercholesterolemia or cholesterol problems and statins and things like that, I want to know, will that have anything to do with your vitamin D availability or the ability to make it yourself or get it from the sun? Also, I want to know, people, when they do tell me they're out in the sun all the time, I remember you telling me before that it has to sit on your skin for a certain amount of time for it to be able to be useful to you. So I'd like you to talk about that too. But continue on, tell me what you're telling. Don, please come back on and let me know when you've got us reconnected, if you would.
Yes, you're connected.
Okay. He says we're back. We're ready. So if you would pick back up where you left off, please. I'm sorry for that technical difficulty.
Do we want to backtrack at all?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, so briefly, vitamin D is made, we evolved to make vitamin D in response to sun exposure, which is different than the other primates on the planet. So when we left the jungle and we lost our fur and walked out of the forest, we became heavily dependent on ultraviolet B radiation to produce this essential nutrient, vitamin D. So vitamin D starts out as cholesterol in our liver, so we need a certain amount of fat in our diet to produce the raw materials. It's converted to 7-dehydrocholesterol and transported in lipids to the subcutaneous fat, so the fat just underlying your skin, waiting for sun exposure. Your sun warms your skin, and the ultraviolet B twists the precursor to vitamin D, this 7-dehydrocholesterol, and sends it back to the liver where it's converted into 25-hydroxy vitamin D, which is actually the blood test you get when your doctor measures, or should be the blood test your doctor measures when he's looking to understand what your capacity for vitamin D production is. you need that step with ultraviolet B radiation. That's a rate-limiting step, at least in our current culture, because we don't go out in the sun as much as we used to. We put sunscreen on, we cover up. I remember talking to some patients in my practice, say, well, you know, I've retired in Florida, I'm outside all the time, and I said, well, tell me what your schedule's like. Well, I get up in the morning, and at 9 o'clock I go outside and work in the garden, and I do this, I do all these things outside, and when it gets warm, around 11:30, I go inside and do inside work until about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, then I go back outside because it's cooled off. I said, well, the window in the middle of the day is actually when you make all the vitamin D, so even in Florida, if you spend only the early mornings and late evenings or afternoons outside, you're missing the window when the maximum amount of ultraviolet B radiation is available to produce vitamin D. So it's key to be outside in the middle of the day with unprotected skin for a certain period of time to make vitamin D. And then supplementation really can occur, you know, the half-life of D3. There are two different forms of vitamin D that you can supplement. Vitamin D2, which is in the United States, is a prescription vitamin D. It's called Drizdol, and it's a little green gel cap that many physicians prescribe. D2 is derived from plants. D3 is what your liver makes from 25-hydroxy-D. And actually your kidney makes it, all kinds of cells in your body make it. The kidney produces a lot of background D3. But D3 is what is the human form or mammalian form of vitamin D, and D2 is a plant source. And there are very significant differences between the two. Vitamin D2 has a half-life of about 2 weeks. And so by the end of a month, basically anything you took at the beginning of the month is gone. So many physicians will prescribe 50,000 units once a month. And they're basically, by the end of that month, it's like you've never been on vitamin D. And so it's such a short half-life that it decays very quickly, as opposed to D3, which has a 10-week half-life and hangs around quite a while and is actually amenable to weekly dosing, even monthly dosing in nursing homes and situations like that where you might consider dosing it once a month. So you want to stick to D3. It's what you can get over the counter. It's the least expensive form of vitamin D. You can get a year's supply of vitamin D3 at your basic discount stores like Walmart and Costco and local discount grocers for probably about $15. That's an entire year's for $15. So that's probably less than the copay for that prescription D2 for 1 month. So stick to D3 when you're supplementing, and then you wanna make sure you're getting enough. And it's really a weight-based dosing. So the bigger you are, the more you need. Someone who's 300 pounds needs twice as much vitamin D as someone who's 150 pounds. It's almost a linear function relative to weight. So in my book, I talk about dosing by weight, and there are tables. A good rule of thumb is 20 units per pound for a Caucasian, about 25 units per pound for someone with darker skin tone to get your vitamin D level from where they tend to be average into the middle of the normal range, which is 40 to 60 nanograms per mil.
Well, that was great. I've had a million people ask me, how do we know how much to take? So that was going to be one of my questions. So what about the statins, since you said that it was made from cholesterol in your liver and statins are fooling with that cholesterol and everybody's on statins? Does that affect it?
Yeah, I think that there are several medications that adversely affect vitamin D metabolism, and many of them are these cholesterol medications. If you look at bile acid binding agents, they don't use many of these anymore for treating cholesterol, but they bind up bile acids. Some patients with either biliary cirrhosis or some other problems may still be taking bile acid sequestrants or bile acid binding agents, but they bind bile, and certain bile acids are there's only a handful of things that bind to the vitamin D receptor, and bile acids are one of those things. So as far as your body's concerned, bile acids look a lot like vitamin D, and so when you take a bile acid binding agent to remove bile acids from your gut, you're also removing any supplemental vitamin D that you've taken. So they'll bind up the vitamin D and take it right out to the toilet. So you have to be careful to either separate those medications in time or take that into consideration, and maybe you want to get your vitamin D from sunlight. There's the other drug out there, everybody's heard of Zetia. It's a medication that basically interferes with the absorption of cholesterol in the gut, and it's often combined with a statin. But Zetia will do the same thing that bile acid sequestrants do, which is inhibit the absorption of vitamin D in the distal small intestine. So there are other drugs like seizure medications, phenobarbitols accelerate the breakdown of vitamin D. There are other anticonvulsants that will interfere with vitamin D metabolism. Those are patients mostly who are institutionalized that you have to pay attention to their medications, and they may require vitamin D supplementation and require measurement of their vitamin D levels with some regularity.
That brings up a question. My family has a history of hypercholesterolemia and coronary artery disease, and so I use beetroot supplements. I can't think what the name of it is, but will some natural thing like that interfere with the vitamin D as well?
I'm not aware of any herbal preparations that off the top of my head that interfere with vitamin D absorption. There isn't a lot of data studying herbal preparations and the specific metabolism of vitamin D that I'm aware of, but it's certainly something I can look into, but I'm not aware of, in this specific case, beet supplements interfering with vitamin D.
Okay, do you understand why I asked that question, right?
Why don't you tell me?
Well, that's because I don't know exactly. I just know that it has betaine in it, and it helps thin out the bile so that I don't have gallbladder issues, because I did have some gallbladder issues, and as soon as I started taking that, it fixed it. So mm-hmm. I thought it had some bile sequestrant properties. And I'm not a doctor, so I'm just asking you. I thought maybe you would know. It would make sense to you or not.
Yeah, I'd have to actually look and see if there's been any actual papers published looking at betaine and its effects on vitamin D metabolism.
I didn't know if it was natural supplements or just pharmaceuticals that would interfere with it.
I'm sure any natural compound that mimics these drug classes that we've mentioned probably can potentially cause the same problem.
Okay, that's good to know. That might be why my D levels didn't raise, but that brings us up to the question of the is the form that you buy at Walmart is that bioavailable, or do you need
to move
to a form that was a sublingual form, and that's when my levels started really changing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the vitamin D that is available widely is either found in a powdered form. Typically, these are synthetic forms of vitamin D. They can extract it from sheepskin and some other ways of using animal products to harvest vitamin D from the skin of animals. There, as far as I know, there's no study showing that one is more bioavailable than the other. I've not seen any studies of problems with bioavailability. I think patients tolerate gel caps and liquids better than they tolerate tablets, just because the tablets usually have lots of fillers, and it may be the fillers that are causing problems with dyspepsia or bloating or whatever problems that they might be having.
Okay. Did you finish? Sorry, I'm having a bad connection. I don't know what's wrong with this connection. Did you get through, or did I interrupt you?
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay, I'm sorry. Could you talk about the role of calcium? Why do we need vitamin D for calcium to get where it needs to go, and does it have anything to do with whether calcium makes plaque or goes into your bones or teeth?
So vitamin D is a hormone that one of its principal functions that we have studied exhaustively is its enhancement of calcium absorption and managing calcium levels in our blood. So absorption of calcium from our gut is mostly dependent on vitamin D. There's still some debate if it's 100% dependent or whether it's something shy of that, but let's just say it's the vast majority of calcium absorption from our gut requires the presence of vitamin D in those cells within your gut. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to take vitamin D simultaneously with calcium for calcium to be absorbed. It just means if your vitamin D levels are normal, then those enterocytes or cells that line your gut will function normally as far as their ability to take up calcium. typically, when our body has a hormone that regulates a nutrient, another example would be insulin and glucose. Typically, if you have a potent hormone that regulates the uptake of a nutrient, you probably don't need to supplement that nutrient to ensure normal levels. You need to eat a healthy diet, but supplementation is probably unnecessary. Now, most of the data on calcium supplementation has not shown that it does anything to improve bone mass, dental health, or any of these things. Whereas vitamin D research has shown that it probably does slightly increase bone mass, may be important for dental health and a whole host of other health outcomes. And so I typically will advocate vitamin D supplementation but not advocate calcium supplementation. Vitamin D, as well as other nutrients like vitamin K, are important for trafficking calcium where you want it to go. So vitamin K and vitamin D help direct calcium to bone partition where calcium is to go. In the absence of some of these nutrients, calcium can go to places you don't want it to go and deposit in areas where there's inflammation or damage. So this is how people get calcific tendonitis. This is how people get calcium in the plaques of their arteries from injury to the lining or endothelium of the arteries, and we call that hardening of the arteries. And I don't know that taking calcium supplements causes that. It probably doesn't help that situation. And there have been a couple of reports suggesting that calcium supplementation in the absence of vitamin D may increase the risk of cardiovascular events. So recently the U.S., the United States Task Force for Preventative Health suggested not taking calcium supplements any longer, that the data, the bulk of the data show that there is no benefit to calcium supplementation. So that kind of reverses some 30 years of recommended calcium supplementation that we've been doing up to this point.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a holistic medical doctor, and he's also a naturopath, and he has a master's in marine biology. And he said, I went to him one day, and he said, Eva, you have blood in your urine. What are you doing? And are you taking calcium? And I went, yes. He said, don't take calcium. Sea turtles live to be about 150 years old, and the only reason they die is because they calcified death. Stop taking calcium. So I thought that was an interesting thing. So you mentioned vitamin K. Which form of vitamin K are you talking about, one or two, or which one? That was something that just caught my attention as important.
I think most of the forms are K2, but and then some of them come in a balance, or they have a combination of the two. I haven't been able to find out whether one or the other is more important for calcium trafficking. And the body may convert it into a balance that it needs at any given time. So I'm not aware of the importance of taking one versus the other at this time.
Okay. What about magnesium? Is there a role with magnesium and vitamin D?
Yeah, actually, magnesium is important for the expression of vitamin D receptors and downstream activation of the receptor and downstream events after activation of the receptor. So magnesium, having a normal magnesium level is important for responding to vitamin D. We discovered that back when there was research going on in rickets back at the beginning of the last century, when they were doing human studies on rickets, they found that kids who were severely magnesium deficient wouldn't respond to vitamin D supplementation. Their rickets wouldn't respond until they had their magnesium replaced. So magnesium is critical. In fact, I think of magnesium as being more important than calcium, and so I routinely ask patients to supplement magnesium citrate or some other chelated form of magnesium. That also plays a role in acid-base balance, and our diet, particularly this grain-based diet that we have, wheat, barley, rye, corn, oats, rice, is a highly acidic diet, and taking magnesium citrate will help neutralize some of that acid as well as enhance the efficacy of the vitamin D that you're supplementing.
That's very interesting. I use transdermal magnesium. Will that do the same thing, or does it need to be taken internally?
Transdermal magnesium does have effects. The effects are well known on the skin. So people who have psoriasis, people who have other skin disorders, they've done studies looking at the Dead Sea where you can wade in these waters or hot springs that are very high in magnesium content, and these patients seem to have some clearing of their skin, or they respond better to medicinal therapies after they've soaked their skin in magnesium. So there's no question it has beneficial effects on our dermis and epidermis. As to whether you can actually raise your blood level with cutaneous exposure to magnesium, I'm not aware of any studies looking at the pharmacokinetics of that kind of magnesium therapy on serum levels. So I wouldn't be surprised if you absorb some, but how much, I don't know.
Okay. What can vitamin D do for skin cancers? Actually, I've been doing a little experiment. I have a skin cancer on my arm, and I've been putting this vitamin D3 serum transdermally on my arm and carrying it through with DMSO and measuring the size of it, and it decreased probably about 50%.
Wow. Yeah, I think that there's probably
using turmeric too. So not just that I use a turmeric capsule, or actually recently I bought like a turmeric oil, essential oil. So I put that and the D3 on the skin cancer, and it's decreased by about 50% in 2 months.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I recently bought a product. You know, I look at my skin and I have all these age spots. I just turned 50 this year, and I grew up in Houston, Texas, and so and I was on a swim team as a kid, and so I don't know how many times I cooked my skin and blistered, but it was too numerous to count. And so I have my skin is older than my chronological age, I think. And I bought this product from Burt's Bees that has rose hip oil and lavender oil and about a dozen different essential oils. And rose hip oil is actually quite high in vitamin A, and they also add some carotenoids to this product, but it's some sort of healing serum, so probably not unlike some of the products you're using right now on this lesion. But vitamin A, you know, retinoids have been shown to promote normal differentiation of cells in the skin, and so retin A is commonly used in pre-malignant skin lesions, either skin lesions that typically are either basal cell precursors or squamous cell precursors, it seems to have an effect. And if you look at studies on psoriasis, They combine retinoids with an active form of vitamin D. So this would be 125 dihydroxy vitamin D or an analog that behaves the same way. And they'll combine retinoids with that, and they get an enhanced effect of vitamin D and or retinoids. So there's sort of a synergy between the two DNA. And that's probably because, you know, if you recall, vitamin D binds to its receptor, and its receptor is a heterodimer, meaning it has two binding sites to it, one for retinoic acid and one for vitamin D3, 125 D3. So to activate the D receptor fully, you really need A and D. And which goes back to the same old ointment we used to put on our baby's bottoms after changing diapers, A and D ointment. And so there's probably a market for that. You know, cod liver oil has the two in it, but I think you would, I tried that once. I'm going to put some cod liver oil in me. I woke up, I smelled like a dead fish, and this is not the thing to do. So I've taken this Burt's Bees product with retinoids from these plant sources, rose hips, and I've taken a D drops product, which is from Canada, which is approved by the equivalent of the FDA in Canada for using replacement in children of vitamin D, and it's just vitamin D3 in mineral oil, cholecalciferol in mineral oil, and I'm spiking this Burt's Bees product with the D, and then I'm gonna try and put this on the areas of my skin that are overexposed to sun. But so, you know, I think that there's something to what you're observing. There's data looking at activated forms of vitamin D and activated forms of retinoids. And when you combine the two, they do have profound effects on skin, the rate of cell turnover in the skin, and normal maturation of skin, so that you can actually forestall or prevent conversion of these premalignant lesions into skin cancer using the two.
I can see it. It's about the size of a little bit bigger than a half dollar underneath my skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a in this within that half dollar there was a thicker part that was about the size of a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, I just don't want to go and get a big hole in my arm. I want to cure it, you know.
Now, was this a basal cell or was it?
I have no idea. I haven't been to the doctor. It's just something I'm watching myself. But it looks like a basal cell.
I would at least get it biopsied so you know what type it is. Obviously, if it's melanoma, you're going to a bit of a more concern, and you're going to want to have, in addition to this approach to management, you probably want to have as much of it removed as possible. But squamous cell and basal cell, particularly basal cell, replicate so slowly that there probably is time to try some of these sorts of approaches to management as opposed to immediately going to surgery. But melanoma spreads pretty quickly, so you don't want to delay.
Okay, I guess I'll do that. I think it's a basal cell because it was flaky, you know. But the flakiness has gone away, and it's smooth now that I've started putting this stuff on there, but you're right. I probably should get somebody to look at it. But
we don't want
it's thinning out.
Story.
You know, where kind of the skin, it's thinning out and shrinking in size. So I'm hopeful. But anyway, I won't keep you on that. So could you talk to us about vitamin D3 and insulin resistance?
There's a lot of associations there. The question is cause or effect, and there's probably a little bit of both, but it may be more effect than cause, or it may just depend on the cell type that we're talking about or the situation. But insulin resistance is probably the health or the biochemical problem that's driving most of the health problems we see today, particularly with our aging population. So as we lose anabolic hormones like gonadal steroids, testosterone, estrogen after 45, 50 years of age, and after 45 or so, I call it senescence, non-gender specific term for 45 to 50 year biochemical transition. So you're losing gonadal steroids, which are anabolic, and you're losing growth hormone, which is anabolic. In the absence of these anabolic hormones, insulin does not work as well as it used to, as it did in the presence of those anabolic hormones. So you develop progressive insulin resistance after that age. Now, our lifestyles are certainly adequate to drive insulin resistance even in the presence of those, and that's borne out by the runaway epidemic of obesity, especially in young children. So kids in middle school and beyond is the fastest growing segment of the population. That and young women are the fastest growing segment of the populations with overweight and obesity. And they're driving insulin and insulin resistance purely with dietary behaviors. So when we the two foods that release insulin to any degree are carbohydrates and protein, and carbohydrates probably are more efficient at doing that than protein is. There's so many carbohydrates, refined grains, really any grain. It doesn't matter if it's refined or not, it's still releasing insulin. But this makes up such a large, 50 to 70% of the American diet is, on average, probably 60-something percentage of the diet is carbohydrates. Our calories come from carbohydrates, and maybe 15, 18% from protein and the balance from fat. And it's so when you drive up insulin and you're eating, grazing on these foods, your insulin levels are continuously elevated, and it really creates a situation that looks a lot like addiction. So just as someone who is, you say they have a surgery for a broken arm, and they get put on a few, give you a few Vicodin or something to treat your postoperative pain, and you take them more often than you should, and in short order, in a matter of weeks, you can get tolerant to those narcotics. Insulin is not a whole lot different than that. So if your insulin levels never return to baseline and they're elevated on an ongoing basis, day after day, it doesn't take too many days in a row before you seem to be hungry all the time because insulin drives up appetite, and your receptors start to downregulate the insulin receptors and say, man, I just can't handle any more of this, and so becomes less sensitive, and that drives insulin production up even further through a feedback loop. So insulin is a hormone that drives lipogenesis, which is storage of energy as fat. And as long as you're storing energy as fat, that includes, that doesn't just, it's not limited to the carbohydrates you're taking in that are being transformed into fatty acids, but it's also driving all of the fat-soluble nutrients into fat, where many of them stay. And there was a study done where they removed the fat from a patient who had had a gastric bypass, had lost some weight but wanted to have some subcutaneous fat removed, and they eluted the vitamin D out of that. This fat was chocked full of vitamin D, and it was trapped in fat. So as long as you have high insulin levels and you're driving lipogenesis, or the production of fat, these fat-soluble nutrients are trapped in that fat. And it's only when you become when you activate lipolysis, or mobilize fat calories for energy, that you liberate not only the energy in fat, but all the fat-soluble nutrients that were trapped there. So we're supposed to be putting a little away and taking it back out, and putting a little away and taking it back out, but keeping it circulating. And most Americans are putting it away and never touching it, because there's always more carbs to follow.
What you're saying.
And so vitamin D gets stuck in fat, and so these patients may be carrying around a lot of vitamin D, but their blood levels are low, and vitamin D can't get out of the fat to do what it's supposed to do, which is all of these other wonderful functions, promoting normal cell differentiation. It even plays a role in insulin release. In animal models, they've shown that the immediate first burst of insulin, and then a more gradual, slower release, the first burst is vitamin D dependent, our cells, insulin sensitivity in our cells. Cells that are vitamin D deficient are less sensitive to insulin than cells that are replete with vitamin D. So D deficiency makes you even more insulin resistant. So just like losing testosterone and estrogen make you more insulin resistant, so does losing or having low vitamin D levels. So it's a tit for tat. So you, low vitamin D levels make you insulin resistant. Insulin resistance and high carbohydrate diets and high insulin levels make you vitamin D deficient.
Okay.
And they feed off of each other.
So for some reason, it was a complicated answer. So I was trying to focus, but for some reason, it made me think that you were saying that we needed to do exercise.
Well, that is one way to liberate fat soluble nutrients is to do something aerobic, which is aerobic exercise or exercise that mobilizes fat as a nutrient is not extreme like running marathons. It's usually 50% to 60% of maximal heart rate, and doing it for a sustained period of time, and that burns a lot of fat. And there are studies suggesting that, you know, for cardiovascular benefit, I don't know if they've looked at how your fuel is partitioned, but when you do brief bursts of exercise, you can get all the cardiac benefits. So 30 minutes versus 3 10-minute workouts. At 3 10-minute workouts is probably better for you. 3 moderate intensity 10-minute workouts is probably better for you than 1 30-minute workout, and that's what most of the data is showing now. Better for you as far as growth hormone release, better for you as far as reducing markers of cardiovascular risk, whether it be fibrinogen or CRP or whatever. And so short burst activity seems to be better than long marathon workouts.
I can probably do that easier than I can do those ones.
Yeah, most of us can do that, fit that into our schedule better than a marathon workout.
Okay, so we have about 20 minutes left. So I'm going to tell you 3 things that I'm interested in that you know more than I do. So if you think there's something more important that we haven't covered that we should cover, please do that. But I was interested in high blood pressure, mood issues, and you keep talking about the gut, so it makes me want to know how important is a healthy gut, I guess, having adequate flora and stuff like that. So take your choice of what you think is the most important for us to hear.
Well, of those 3, the most important is, I would say, is probably the gut, just because we're transitioning, medicine is sort of transitioning into mostly based on technological advances that allow us to analyze gut flora more efficiently. We used to have to actually take poop or whatever you want to call it and actually try and culture out individual species of organisms. And now you can just do these SNPs where they just look at RNA and DNA profiles of the bugs that are growing in there. They can identify quantitatively what's growing in your gut, and it's just so much easier than the microbiology of trying to grow this stuff out. And so it's completely transformed the analysis of the microbiome or the microbiology that is growing in and on us. And so every few months they change the number of species they think are there, and it's, you know, it's somewhere between 500 and, who knows, 1,200, 1,500 different species of bugs. It's in the order of 10 trillion or more bacteria in and on us. So we're basically a transportation mechanism for bacteria. There's more bacterial DNA in and on us than there is human DNA, and so we're basically here for the bugs, not the other way around. And so they're finding that the profile of bacteria that grow in our gut, in particular, because that's where the majority of it is, mirrors specific disease states. In other words, it's a fingerprint for a disease state. So diabetics look a little different than non-diabetics. Obese look a little different, look different than non-obese. A rheumatoid arthritis patient looks different than an osteoarthritis patient. And so there's clearly significant differences between disease states and states of health and what's growing in our gut. And as we begin to collect more data and understand the differences between these states of health and what's going on in our gut, then we'll start moving rapidly into, okay, how can we manipulate what's growing in our gut? Now, unfortunately, I think the pharmaceutical industry is going to go crazy with medications to alter what's growing in your gut, and I think they should be focusing on diet, but they don't focus on diet for cardiovascular disease or anything else. So what makes me think they're going to focus on what we eat to regulate the expression of any disease we might be at risk for by altering gut flora? But I'm most intrigued by the research that's going on there, and it's gaining momentum in all different fields looking at this idea. And so I think over the next decade or two, we're going to see tremendous advancements in understanding of what the gut, how the gut's involved in these disease states. And hopefully, maybe this gives us another tool to look back and say, okay, you change your diet to eating X, Y, or Z, and your gut flora all of a sudden shifts to what we would consider healthy or normal. Wow, okay, so this is probably what we should eat. Because from currently, what we are looking at are long-term health outcomes to decide what diet we should eat. So, well, let's put people on a certain diet, and then let's see who has heart attacks over the next 20 years. Nobody has time to wait 20 years to collect data, and how many people are going to stay in the study for 20 years, and how many people are going to comply with the recommendations for that duration? Whereas you can probably shift what bacteria grow in the gut within a couple of weeks of changing the diet. And if we determine that there is a certain profile of a fingerprint of a gut flora that's healthy, and we can put someone on a diet in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, know whether it's accomplished that, now we've shortened the observation period, and doing studies is much more feasible when it comes to diet, because you only have to comply for a month or something like that to see these changes. So I think it's going to open up a whole host of opportunities in understanding disease and different ways that we can manipulate it through diet, maybe targeted supplements, probiotics. And probiotics is we don't really have a clue what we're doing. And most probiotics that we give patients are fermenting bacteria like lactobacillus. And the reason why patients feel somewhat better on lactobacillus is because they're eating so many carbohydrates in their diet that they've overwhelmed their gut's ability to ferment all of this starch. And so when you give them some more ammunition to ferment the starch with, they feel better. Otherwise, they have all of this excess carbohydrate that's not being digested properly, and it's causing problems. So instead of putting patients on probiotics, I generally tell them to just get off all the carbohydrates, and you won't need the probiotics to help you digest them all. I'm going a little bit against the stream, especially in integrative holistic medicine, where everybody thinks, oh, no, these things are great, man. And I'm thinking, well, I don't even think we know what we're doing, and maybe we should just cut the carbohydrates out instead of adding more bacteria to digest them. So anyway, I think the gut holds a lot of promise, and I think it's going to hopefully help drive our understanding of what we should be eating with clear-cut data. Mood and vitamin D, and so the gut and vitamin D, where's the connection there? Well, if vitamin D in your, at least dietary or supplemental vitamin D, is absorbed in the distal ileum, so much of it doesn't make it to the small intestine, but what gets to the small intestine in part may be selected by vitamin D. So bacteria that get through the gastric trap and the transit time of the small intestine and make it to the large intestine may be in part selected by vitamin D. Vitamin D in studies on animal models where they look at chemicals that cause stress on the gut wall and cause the gut to become more permeable to bacteria, among other things. They've shown that vitamin D helps to heal the gut from that stress or chemicals, and it makes the gut more resistant to that stress. So vitamin D does seem to improve the health of the enterocyte barrier. So if you think of your skin on the outside that you see, your gut lining is the skin on the inside, and it's protecting you from all the bacteria and digestive enzymes that are helping to process your food. And the health of that lining of your gut is in part and significantly so dependent on vitamin D. And so normal D levels will help enhance a gut integrity. So that's where vitamin D may play a role in selecting what bugs thrive in your gut. It may protect you from any invasive forms of in the microbiome that want to try and penetrate the gut mucosa, and it helps maintain the health of the mucosa. Mood. There's been we're all familiar with seasonal affective disorder, and there's been a handful of small studies showing that probably the majority of seasonal affective disorder, or at least 50% of it, is due to vitamin D deficiency. There's no question that bright lights have some effects on circadian rhythm, and those alter certain hormone levels, melatonin, and other things in the brain, so it's bright light as well as vitamin D. But vitamin D can actually ameliorate many of the symptoms of seasonal affective disorder. And then in major depressive disorder, there's a study, a TROMSO study, which was done in Sweden. Or Norway, excuse me, Tromsø, Norway, which is similar to Framingham, Massachusetts. It's a long-term study in a population in Tromsø. They took a subset of obese patients with major depressive disorder and put some on a trivial amount of vitamin D, like 400 units, another group on 20,000 units a week, and the other on 40,000 units a week, and then followed them for 3 years and showed that the groups on 20 and 40, particularly the 40,000 a week group, showed significant improvements in Beck depression scales over the three-year period. So vitamin D does have mood-elevating effects in major depression and in seasonal affective disorder. I don't know that you can just take vitamin D and not do other things. I think talk therapy of certain kinds of cognitive behavioral therapy can be very effective, if not more effective than medications. And so you'd probably want to do some combination of things for management.
Well, after hearing everything that you've said about gut and vitamin D, healing gut, it would make sense to me that it could probably affect serotonin levels.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our gut is actually the main area of production for serotonin in our body. And so there's a number of scientists, not so many gastroenterologists, mostly neurobiologists, who look at this gut brain axis and how many of the neurotransmitters that affect mood and behavior are produced in the intestines. Certainly serotonin in that entire system comes largely from the gut. And it probably makes some sense when you think about, again, I always try and think of sort of a Paleolithic perspective on health and nutrition and biology of disease. And you have to think that, well, if food is so critical for survival, and the appropriate foods and nutrient composition is appropriate for survival, then then somehow there must be some communication between what we're eating, how that's being processed, and reinforcing the behaviors that that led to the intake of the appropriate nutrition. And so there has to be some loop there. And so the gut has to somehow talk back to the brain and say, okay, that was good, man. That meal was great, had everything I needed in it, and I want to reinforce that behavior. You just had to bring that to me, so I'm going to make you feel really good right now. And so,
well, what about stomach acid? Would it play a role? You know, because as we, I interviewed this guy the other day, Jonathan Wright, who said as we get older, we don't produce as much stomach acid, and everybody has reflux, and they think it's too much stomach acid. Really, it's not enough stomach acid. Would there be any connection with vitamin D and the gut and stomach acid and all these other problems, health problems?
I don't know. Specifically, I'm not aware of vitamin D and stomach acid, whether there's a direct connection there. There are a number of patients. I mean, everything is not, I call it the switching off autopilot. So after 45, Mother Nature says, okay, you're of no reproductive value to me any longer, so I'm withdrawing all my resources and I'm switching off autopilot. You're on your own, and you're going to have to make everything happen without me. And so she pulls back all these gonadal steroids and growth hormone and a whole host of other things, and melatonin and everything. And now you have to figure out, okay, how do I get a good night's rest without melatonin? How do I protect my bone and muscle mass without growth hormone and gonadal steroids? How do I absorb all these nutrients without the added efficiency of these anabolic steroids? How do I digest my food properly if I don't have as much stomach acid, and my transit time may be different, and my bacteria and my gut may change? And it's just all of these things are going on in the post 45 time frame, and most of us haven't been paying attention up until that point because our health has been so good, and that's just because all these hormones have been making everything happen without any conscious effort required. And afterwards, you have to start thinking about, okay, I got to make sure I exercise, I got to make sure I do this, because you're now trying to make all these things happen manually. And, you know, I tell some of my patients who are older, I say, you know, you're probably not digesting things as efficiently, so you might want to think about crock pot cooking and soups and these sorts of ways of preparing foods, because heat will help denature some of the proteins and things and will make them more digestible to a gut that's not working as well. And so we probably need to change, in part, change the way we cook and prepare foods as we age, to make sure we're getting the nutrition that's in those foods as our gut and our intestinal system ages. And I think these are all things that we really haven't paid a whole lot of attention to, but they just make sort of common sense to me.
Wow, that's so interesting, everything you've been saying. Especially that thing about the bacteria being related to specific diseases. Where do we find out more about that?
these names in my head. At Washington University in St. Louis.
I'm sorry, I missed one, the first part of that sentence. Was there a name?
I think his name is, I'm trying to look it up real quick here.
That's new information. Nobody else has said it. I've not seen it anywhere. That's so interesting.
Let's see. I'll get you a name here, Mike.
Sorry?
I'll get you a name here momentarily.
Okay. I don't know
Gordon.
What's wrong with
His it. Name is, you can go to the Gordon Lab. It's Gordon Lab at WUSTLE.edu. It's Washington University. It's the abbreviation for Washington University in St. Louis. So
W-U-S-T-L-E.
G-O-R-D-O-N lab. And he's written a number of seminal articles on the microbiome, and his entire lab is focused on, I think his first name is Jeffrey Gordon, and he's written a number of papers, and many of his postdocs have gone on to start labs that are working on the biology of the gut. And that's one scientist who he's associated obesity with a specific pattern of bugs in the gut. But if you just go to the National Library of Medicine or you just Google microbiome and scientific studies, you'll get so many matches, make your head spin. So there are so many people now doing research. He came out with some seminal papers in 2006, so quite a while ago. But since then, the field has just exploded with researchers, and there's, I think, usually when that happens, then lots of money comes into that idea, and it kind of takes off, and it certainly has done that in the last two or three years.
That's just so fascinating. Makes so much sense, too. Okay, we've got 1 minute. Why don't you wrap up and tell everybody again where they can find you and find your book and find your author?
So my website is www.drjamesdowd.com. So drjamesdowd.com. And you can get my book, The Vitamin D Cure. There's a revised edition that came out in late June, and it has 130 more references in it. I rewrote two chapters. It has all new menus and recipes in it. So it's got a lot of information in it. I have a blog on that website. And we just renewed the website, so we're changing some things. I'm trying to add some video and other things to make it a little more friendly to all these new digital devices that have come out just since the first edition was released. And I'm in Michigan, and you can send comments to the blog or to the website. And if you have arthritis and you're in Michigan, I can probably help.
You know, I'm going to run a little bit over. I hope I'm okay. Quickly, some woman contacted me, a young woman, like in her 20s, and said that she had some kind of disease that was making all of her muscles and her whole body turn hard so she couldn't move. And I told her about you. Is that something, if you said the word, I would know it. Does that ring a bell with you?
Yeah, there are some diseases like that. In fact, I saw a patient just last week who has a very rare disease called stiff man syndrome, which is related to type 1 diabetes and a gene or an antibody to a specific protein and Parkinson's disease. And so they have some musculoskeletal manifestations to this autoimmune phenomenon. But, yeah, that's someone who I could probably help or at least point them in the right direction if they're not someone local.
What is the name of that disease? So I can see if it rings is the one to be
said. That specific disease is actually called stiff man syndrome, SMS. SMS or stiff man syndrome, and these patients commonly make GAD65, GAD65 antibodies, and there's oftentimes family history of type 1 diabetes and Parkinson's disease.
So that is something there's hope for her if she contacts you?
There are some treatments that are not tremendously effective, but there are some treatments that improve quality of life, and some patients respond to immunosuppression to reduce the antibody production.
Okay. Thank you so much. This has been a fascinating interview. I mean, listening to all this, and I love hearing the information. Thank you so much for coming on my show. I hope you'll come back.
I will.
Thank you, and have a good evening.
Good night.
Good night.